Blog Talk Radio.
I just love that sound. Blog Talk Radio. Just beautiful, isn't it? No, I know we're all sick of it. We're part of our bonding experience to hear that Blog Talk Radio intro. Still haven't substituted. I really haven't found a music clip that seems perfect to intro this course. But if anybody has suggestions, let me know. So we're rolling again here, and tonight we're talking about migration and diaspora engagement, and we are completely delighted to have Samar Arya. Samar, I think I may have butchered your last name, so you going to help me there?
That's right. It's Arya, Samar Arya.
Arya, yeah. See, I had a feeling as I looked at that again. So, and in fact, I think I've been misspelling it on Twitter. So everything's going to be straightened out from now on. And Samar's with us. She's the founder and the executive director of the Diaspora African Women's Network, DAWN, an organization whose mission is to develop and support talented women and girls from the African diaspora focused on African affairs. She has been a participant in all kinds of settings, including the White House Champions of Change, and delighted to have her on tonight. So, Samar, welcome.
Thank you. I'm very excited to be on this fantastic Blog Talk Radio as well.
The way we've been starting, since this is a course about entrepreneurship, and entrepreneurship, at least in my mind, is a lot about creating a personal narrative, writing your own life story. So we start with personal narrative. So why don't you tell us a little bit about where you've come from, where you've been, and where you're going?
Okay. Well, my name is Samar Arya. My family is from Eritrea in East Africa. I was born in the States, and I've lived, in many different places around the country due to just personal situations. But I've always known about Eritrea's history, its struggle for independence from Ethiopia. And my first trip to Eritrea was at the age of 14 when it became independent shortly after. So since about my teenage years, I've managed to live, at that time we were in Minnesota, but I just went back and forth to Eritrea. I went to law school and did variations of different careers. And as a lawyer, I worked on the Eritrea-Ethiopia peace process. And then I went into Congress to learn sort of the ins and outs of how federal government works and how decisions are made towards Africa. I worked as a staffer there. And then I went sort of into the nonprofit space and international development space, which was absolutely fantastic. Somewhere in between all that, I think going to Eritrea and coming back, I started to understand sort of the diaspora perspective that I had, and that's where DAWN, this organization, began, and that's how it was created. So DAWN started 5 years ago really as a volunteer project, as a volunteer thing. It needed to happen, but I couldn't quit my job to do it. But finally, I had to take a leap, and 6 months ago, I've made the 100% commitment to DAWN. I'm very excited, and we're a newly established nonprofit organization. We're hosting events as usual, but beginning to build our base across the country. So we have about 200 members, women of African descent, of the diaspora, rather, because that includes more than the kind of what we think of African descent. It's a lot bigger than what we're used to hearing. But we have 200 women. We represent 28 African countries and more. Our members are all over the world, in Europe, Middle East, primarily in Africa, in America. And most of our members are in New York and D.C., San Francisco, Minneapolis. We've just gotten new members in Ohio and Philadelphia and Kansas even. So it's really exciting, the kind of connections that DAWN is making, and I'm very excited about it. Can you guys still hear me?
Sorry, yeah, I had put myself on mute because I was coughing. My suspicion is that for a lot of folks on the call. They're thinking, great, we're finally getting to the good stuff. They really relate to this topic of migration and diaspora engagement. And other people may be wondering, so wait, what is diaspora exactly again? And so why don't we pause for a little bit and talk about this notion of a diaspora, how you understand it, what it means to you personally, and kind of what it's significance is in the context of a course on entrepreneurship and globalization.
Yeah, I think, I mean, it's tough. There's always, you know, new terms and jargon, and what does this word diaspora mean? And I have to be honest, I didn't even really think of it until a few years ago. But, you know, generally it means people of a certain national or ethnic identity, or people outside of their country who have left the country, but still maintain a relationship with it. People who identify themselves as the diaspora are people who are living outside of the country or the continent, as is very often the case in Africa and Asia. We're seeing numbers of people of those communities refer to themselves as diaspora, but who also maintain a relationship with their homeland. So either through familial relationships of sending money back home, or taking trips back and forth for vacation or business, or even what we're seeing now increasingly are people returning back to their countries of origin to start businesses or run for office or build an organization. And so diaspora really encompasses this broad spectrum of you know, let's say for Americans, you know, we often think of immigrants as, oh, well, then that's what you are somehow. You're an immigrant, or how is this different than the immigrant story? And, I mean, one way to look at it is my parents are immigrants, and so I'm part of that new American story, but I'm also American because I'm born here, I'm a citizen, and I've lived here my entire life. But I identify as diaspora because I have a relationship with Eritrea and with people, and my life is connected to my homeland. So I've learned the language, I've gone to cultural school, I've infused it with my day-to-day life, and luckily I've been able to do it as a profession. We're seeing more and more people around the world hold maintain a relationship like this and choose to, you know, keep that hyphenated name of I'm Italian-American and I'm Eritrean-American and I'm, you know, this and that. In even more cases, some people don't need the hyphen. They just are. You know, a friend of mine, you know, she's Kenyan, and she goes around the world all the time as a Kenyan diaspora woman. But she lives in the United States. And it's really a process of self-identification. In Dawn, our biggest point is that how you choose to identify yourself is up to you, and we respect your decision. If you feel that you are a person of African descent, you know, we're not going to ask you for proof or anything, because it's sort of proven in how you live. It's proven in your ancestral and your day-to-day life. And, you know, whether or not we like the word diaspora, maybe I think it should stay, but it might change in a few years. But it's this concept of a transnational identity and relationship. And I think for many who are part of the older diaspora, let's say, for instance, there's African-American communities and organizations in the United States, that they too have a relationship with Africa because of their ancestral bond and because of their desire to forge and maintain relationships. So it's so inclusive and so broad, it kind of is a big tent for everyone to fit in if they wanted to, if they felt that they were a part of it. I don't know if that's just too pie in the sky or too ambiguous, but it's working, and it's working. It's resonating with people because we have more and more populations around the world that have lives that go across boundaries and borders and continents. And so the reality is that more and more people around the world do see themselves as having two homes, or calling themselves, I'm from here and I live here and I'm both. I don't know. I'd also be really interested to hear other people's take on it, because sometimes I feel I'm so close to the balancing act and maintenance of my whole identity in this diaspora sense. But yeah.
Well, actually, yeah, in our in-person class here at Mason, we were having a little bit of a discussion about transnational identities and diaspora populations, and I pulled the class, and you've been really eloquent on sort of the fact that the diaspora identification isn't necessarily one-to-one with either being a first generation, I mean, being an immigrant, or else being a child of an immigrant. But that's the way I framed it in class. I just asked, how many folks in the class were either first generation, either immigrants themselves or children of immigrants. And, at least three-quarters of the class raised their hands. So I think it is something that a lot of people, at least in this group in Northern Virginia, but I'm quite confident, and Ashoka, you online can relate to. But I wanted to actually ask you about this, what you see as a trend. I actually think that there is research and kind of analysis to support the trend that you just described. Let's take that as a reality that more and more people are sort of identifying with their diaspora groups, and what do you see as being the driver there? What's causing that trend to happen?
Well, I mean, first of all, the UN. I mean, there's estimates that there's about 215 million people. I think there was a report. UN, a 2009 statistic from the UN, that about 215 million people live outside of their countries of origin. And the reasons they leave are many. The causes for migration, whether it's about economic opportunity or lack thereof, the impact of climate change and the reality of having to be either displaced by natural or man-made disasters such as conflict. And also just other levels of insecurity or desires for a better life. It's becoming easier to move around. And with that, the way in which people are moving allows them to still be connected thanks to the globalization and the technology that we have and the connections that didn't exist 10 years ago, 15 years ago. So, I mean, as the world has become increasingly globalized, we are getting smaller. We're connected to each other, and it's easier to move around. And in many ways, much of the conversation tends to unfold around immigration and reactions to migration patterns. We're seeing a backlash of a European backlash against immigrants coming legally and illegally from many places that are affected by climate change and insecurity and lack of economic opportunity. And it's hitting societies really hard. The greatest challenge is, absorbing all of these new arrivals, but also trying to understand what's causing them to move. That conversation around immigration is very serious, and it's a challenge. And almost every country I've worked in, that's what everyone talks about is all these new people coming in. So the flow just seems to have intensified and increased, and whatever the root causes are, there are many. The reality is that people are coming back and forth. And it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's actually an opportunity for growth, for prosperity, for chances to learn and make stronger connections. What many may see as a threat when you have new arrivals actually could be a great opportunity for new businesses and new ways of thinking and innovative partnerships. I remind myself to always look at it on the positive end. So even without this sort of extensive reasons of why there's different migration patterns. Even if we were to stay, in the United States, if my parents, for instance, came in 1968 at a time where there were African exchange programs at USAID under the Kennedy administration inviting university students to come on student student exchange programs, and that's how my parents came. And they came for college and graduate school, and they had every intention of going back, as most people do, because they came for one reason, for school, to go back and work at home. But the situation in Eritrea, which then at the time was Ethiopia, was too unstable. And they ended up staying here, which is exactly how America was built, exactly the whole idea of the land of immigrants. And it's afforded me the ability and the opportunity to know my heritage and share it with others and build bridges and work back in Eritrea, which I did for about two and a half years. But for 3 years, I went back and forth. And I've managed to do this for the last 10 years, as many others have.
So I got it was a question from you from on Twitter. Where do you really feel at home? Equally in both places, more in one than another?
It's really funny. I was just joking about this yesterday with a friend of mine. When you're from the diaspora, you feel home in both places. And at the same time, you don't feel completely at home in either one, because your heart and your mind and your consciousness is wedded with both. You know, I'll admit, I grew up very, and I'm very proud of being Eritrean. Everyone will know that. I can sit and elaborate on all the reasons why. But when I grew up firmly believing that I was Eritrean. I was born in New York City. I had never seen the country until I was 14, but I just walked around here like, I'm Eritrean, and no, I'm not American. I hadn't seen myself as an American, for many reasons related to race and being a minority in a, you know, largely white state. I held on to this identity, and I clarified to people what African American meant to me. And it was just a fascinating time. I remember this. It wasn't until I moved to Eritrea to work as a professional and lived there. It wasn't until I had, stayed long enough to really become a resident, where I was not just visiting. I was paying bills. I was getting stopped by police because I jaywalked. You know, those are the kind of things that remind you that you actually live here.
Right.
That was when I realized that, wait a minute, I'm American too. I am more American than I realized. I came back from that 3 years. You know, I returned to the States with a deeper understanding of myself and the hyphenated bicultural person that I am, the hyphenated Eritrean American. And I had to remind myself to embrace it. And so I feel at home when I'm in Asmara. I feel at home when I'm in Nairobi. It's crazy. I feel at home when I am on the continent. But I also feel very much at home in the States. And I think that's a blessing to be able to have two places that I can call home. And I'm genuinely proud, and I feel lucky. And I want others of the diaspora to also embrace that biculturalness and embrace the fact that you don't have to move back home. You don't have to abandon the country that your family came from. You can actually enjoy both and help both. And Dawn is proving that, though. We've tapped into this demographic of women in particular, next generation women, who are doing just this, maintaining both homelands and feeling at home in both. It's really wonderful.
Well, now I want to actually talk a little bit more about exactly what Dawn does, and also bring it around to entrepreneurship and the way, this particular role that diaspora plays in supporting business ventures in general. We can talk about remittances, and then beyond that, you know, this sort of particular topic of diaspora engagement in entrepreneurship at home country, or as a resource to, say, people in the United States who are interested in connecting globally. But before I do that, I've got a little surprise for you. We got a little Twitter moment here. Your friend and mine, Teddy, I already butchered Semar's last name, so you're going to help me out. Tell me exactly
Rouge.
How I pronounce it. Rouge?
Yeah.
Teddy Rouge is on. Teddy is on. And,
hey, Semar, how's it going?
I'm great to hear you.
I got to know both of them on Twitter, and so Teddy is the co-founder of Project Diaspora, and, you know, I'm going to ask him to to say a little bit about the work that he does, you know, in a similar space, and then, you know, we'll pick up where we were with Semar.
So Project Diaspora was started as really as an experiment back in 2007 as a way for me to engage with other members of the diaspora, because I was starting to engage more with the continent through my family. As pretty much every member of the diaspora does, is that you begin pulling that string that connects you back to the continent. And that was around the rise of social media, and I wanted to discover other people like me, and it offered them an opportunity to be able to engage with them online, and blogging was pretty big. This was pre-Facebook, pre-Twitter, mostly it was blogging. So I began blogging about issues on the continent, and I wanted to discover what other members of the diaspora were talking about and dealing with. And it's been successful in the way that it's created multiple platforms as a way for me to test different ways of engagement and encouraging other members of the diaspora to do the same, and to be proud and to realize that they do have a role. The continent is large, but however small the change that you do. Is actually transformative down the line. And, my big thing was education, investing in education, because largely started Project Diaspora because I saw the change that it created when I invested in my siblings who are still in the continent for them to get a degree or to further their education. I started seeing tangible changes in their lives, and that opened my eyes to how transformative our small little activities can be. Now, what would happen if we took those activities simply from a one-to-one solution to a one-to-many solution towards investment in real projects and communities? How could we impact those? And then we started looking into remittances, and we were kind of blown away by the numbers, and then all of that led to exploring really what keeps us connected, and then really kind of trying to define the diaspora, especially at least in the African sense. And I started to see more and more members of myself, Semhar and myself, we met on Twitter. She called me up out of the blue one day and, really just started talking passionately. And I was like, this is somebody I need to know. This is somebody I need to collaborate with. And that's happened with a lot of members of the diaspora. We've just met, as issues arise, pertinent to the continent, you're starting to see more and more members of the diaspora. And I think, Semhar, you touched on a little bit earlier on the importance of technology and how that's keeping our connectivity to the continent even tighter, because we have something that your parents and perhaps my parents, when they came in the, in the 80s or in the 70s and 60s, didn't have. Back then it took 30 days for you to send a letter and maybe another 30 days for you to get it back. And the longer that took, the less likely you were going to maintain that relationship or that tightness in the bond. Right now, I can get on the phone right now and call my mother in the village. I mean, she's got an iPad and we can text. She doesn't have any running water or electricity, but she has an iPad. And we can video message. I mean, that is keeping the bond much, much tighter. So it's just like you've never left. So you feel very tightly tied to the continent, to your community, to your culture. You don't get to lose much of anything. And I think there's a little bit of a difference between the first generation, those that are born here, and those that do come here right now within this age of tightened communication and awareness, in that we never really lose that grip on the continent. So our identity is probably less hyphenated than somebody who was born here. I've been here over 20 years, and I adamantly still hold on to my Ugandan passport for whatever reason. As soon as I arrived here, within a month of being here, I looked up at my dad and I was like, I'm never going to be an American. And I was 12 years old. what did I know at 12 to say that I still want to maintain my identity as a Ugandan and to maintain that tie with the country? But every time I look at that passport, it reminds me that I have a duty to my country. And every time that I come back here, you know, for whatever reason it is, I feel a little bit guilty. So that I am here instead of there doing something tangible. But I have to remind myself is that my office is here in the United States, but my home is in Uganda and back on the continent.
Well, yeah. Well, that's great. Certainly on the connectivity part, I'm a pretty disconnected member of the Tunisian diaspora. Most of my relatives are in France, but certainly at the time of the Arab Spring, even being relatively disconnected, being able to follow events literally minute by minute,
yeah.
Particularly when they came to Egypt, and my wife thought it was just my, Twitter fixation, run amok. But I had to tell her, look, this is incredible stuff happening. And, two, 3 days later, it was on the front pages. But it was happening minute to minute on Twitter before that. And it's a sense of connection that really is just unbelievable. And I know all of us, have experienced that. We've talked about identity. We've talked about, we just alluded to connectivity. I want to really get to this word engagement. Both of you have described your organizations about, as being in some sense, dedicated to that as well as to other aspects of identity and community. Can you tell us, each of you, tell us stories of engagement that where either your own stories or members who have sort of been involved, created the sort of impact that Teddy was just talking about?
Simran, you can go.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, like I said earlier, even just the idea of diaspora and understanding what this community is first has been, I think, the biggest challenge so that we can then get into what kinds of engagement matter. Let's look at the 80s, the 90s, when African countries were new and emerging. They had communities here, but they were largely viewed as immigrants, right, or people here for a specific purpose, a finite period, and going back. And that is still the case in many parts of the country, but as the diaspora and the connections to maintain your identity as a diaspora have become easier, so too has it become easier to assert ourselves as a diaspora. I guess what I'm saying is it's really hard to say here's how you engage when we haven't introduced ourselves. But in the last 5 years, I think we've seen a plethora of quote-unquote diaspora organizations propping up, which
yeah.
Basically we're introducing ourselves, explaining and allowing people to learn that there is a whole part of American communities that are transnational, and this is how we are. There's some great groups that I just wrote down that I wanted to use as examples of just quickly in their names. In addition to Teddy's organization, Project Diaspora, and mine, Dawn, regularly on Twitter, I follow Birthright Armenia, Turkish Philanthropy. There's another group that is coming very soon, Africans in Diaspora Aid by Innovate Africa on Twitter, those of you who know her. There's examples of diaspora organizations claiming their space. When that space is finally claimed, we're beginning to see engagement on a wide level of on a wide variety of levels. In the West, or here in the United States, or even in Europe, in the UK, for instance, there's a lot of networking receptions and chances for visitors of, let's say, the country of origin to meet with diaspora communities. In 2009, Don hosted a reception with the International Visitors Leadership Program, which is a program that is run by State Department that brings in a delegation of visitors for about a 3 to 4 week tour of the United States. And these visitors are often leaders in their communities, in nonprofit, in business, education, in government, sort of, the chance for leadership exchange and learning. And Don, we put a reception together for 40, a delegation of 40 African women. And I tell you, it was the most beautiful thing. We have some photos on our website. It was a great moment for women in the diaspora to meet the actual women that are running things in Mali or Nigeria or Senegal or Ethiopia, any country. But it was also important that those women in those countries got to see the ways in which Africans are making leaps and bounds in the developed world as well. It was a source of learning and inspiration, opportunities to collaborate. Many future business arrangements emerged out of those networking. And so it's two very untapped demographics and a space which I think used to exist when there were more exchange programs, but that's another conversation. There's a learning component that diaspora can help facilitate and bring to different audiences. And in many ways, we're catalysts, we're bridge builders, we are conduits. And I think it's critical that diaspora understand that role as conduits and bridge builders for business, investment, exchange, learning, even issues, social issues affecting each country, if it's about poverty or education. And the diaspora have a role in promoting that sort of prosperity. But I am very careful and cautious that we need to understand that diaspora's role is limited. I very much agree with Teddy that we need to have this distinction about who can really bring about the change on the ground. And, you know, diaspora are a stakeholder, and we can encourage better engagement. But it really takes actors on the ground in both sides, if that makes sense.
I think that is important for us to understand definitely our role. We are coming of age and through these conversations, we are encouraging each other to participate and to engage in more than just one way. And some of us really are engaging out of a sense of duty without realizing how it has a much wider impact. I mean, just sending remittances to your family, you might think that that's a personal thing. But, you know, if you get out there and look at it, almost all of us are doing it. And almost all of us are transitioning from simply just saying we want to send remittances for this or that family project that is happening. Our eyes are opening up to the opportunities of investment, and we're putting the monies together. And institutions now are starting to see us as conduits for change, as transformational figures, as bridge figures that can actually do something, that can bring our intellectual capacity, combine it with our remittances for a transformational force on the economic front. And the other thing I think in the our rising to the fore is the fact that we are beginning to realize that we have a voice in the development of our own continent. We're beginning to participate in the conversation. There's never been a time where I've seen so many members of the diaspora so impassioned about just about everything. Every time that there is an issue, you discover new members of the diaspora who are highly educated, highly articulate, and you wonder why has the rest of the world taken up the opportunity to talk for the continent when there are so many voices that have never been discovered. But thanks to social media, we're rising to the occasion and taking up the microphone and speaking up. Now, a lot, you know, there's a lot of fervor in that space, but we're not organized. But it's good to see the energy. You can start to see we are really at the primordial stage of discovering our voice and our agency and how powerful we really can be. And I think out of all of this craziness, out of all of this fervor, this activity, we will discover that we kind of need to begin organizing into a transformational force and really lean on our governments and really lean on our civil societies to do something, really lean on or become influential in the economic landscape to create jobs, to to go beyond just taking care of our families, but to also just take care of our communities. So when we talk about engagement, I think we need to recognize that there isn't any one way that is better than the other. All of it is needed. For all of the skills that we pick up here in the West, every one of them is needed on the continent. It's far too late a time to continually let the continent be run by outsiders. We will never have any say at the table if other people are running our affairs. It will never happen. Africa will always be a recipient, and we will never have equal play at the table. We won't be invited to the table unless we flex our economic muscle. Everyone is coming and taking our remittances. Members of the African community are fleeing and going to the diaspora for whatever reason, for the various reasons that they are there. But even then, we need to capture and do something great with this diaspora community. Those of us that are deciding, you know what, I've learned all that I can in the West. I've done all that I can in the West. It's time for me to take my skills home. And some of us are going through that transnational stage where we're spending half of our time here and now half of our time there. And a lot of that space is growing of us that are able to get on a plane and go and be constantly transient. I'm one of those. I feel like I'm undecided. I'm comfortable in my village, you know, barefoot and walking around with everybody else and in the garden with my mother, as I am, in the office giving a presentation here in D.C. So those two parts of us are important, because I think as members of the transnational diaspora, as a vocal diaspora, we immediately represent the continent, and the things that we do, the things that we say are being heard. And a lot of us who are vocal are sitting in high-level positions where we can influence and be the difference maker at the table. And I'm loving seeing that space, but I yearn for a time when we can really be recognized. But before we get there, we have to organize.
Yeah, Teddy, I'm listening to it. I'm like, this is so interesting. It's reminding me how new and how young the African diaspora really is compared to other diaspora generations. I mean, it's important to keep this conversation global. And I've found over the last few years, in my line of work over the years, I've had the opportunity to meet other diaspora representatives. And, you know, as a congressional staffer, I got to meet with Armenians and Turks and Iranians and Irish. And I have to say, there are so many lessons to learn from each other as diaspora communities, new and old. And really, honestly, one of the greatest, I've learned some of the greatest things in organizing and making yourself heard through the efforts of other diaspora, previous ones in particular, like the Irish diaspora, Armenian, were actually quite good, and the Iranian diaspora, who were quite active in a few years back before it became more and more about Iranian politics. This is when it was still kind of quiet in Iran 5-6 years ago. But, you know, those communities that have maintained their relationships across boundaries, they learned the tricks to organizing and being heard. And that was before social media. And now we have an advantage within the African diaspora that social media and access to technology is actually easier on the continent than probably anywhere else. So it's actually a nice moment to look back and say, you know, there's many challenges that the continent's facing that the diaspora can help. But there's also many lessons to learn of the ways in which diaspora have organized collectively, have used their voices as constituents, you know, as citizens in their foreign country or their adopted homeland. And I think it's part of organizing is knowing who you are, what you want, and how that other person can help you get it in a way that benefits them. I mean, it's a mutual goal. Diaspora, out of everybody, I think diaspora should be able to best articulate, you know, the commonalities and the shared interests and the goals. That's what I want to see us be able to do as African diaspora. Mm-hmm. I want us to be able to pitch and share and sell and show and really let people see what is so great about this continent we love so much, and let them see it in a way that it makes people want to invest, want to come, want to respect us with the dignity that we deserve, want to make us the leaders not the followers. You know, that's what's important, and it's a huge challenge because of the historical narratives that have been piled on with it, with Africa and its people. But this is why I say we should know better than anyone how to speak more than one language, how to speak more than one narrative. And those of us that are in Canada, that are in the U.S., that are in Europe, that's all we've learned to do. We've had to maintain that multiple conversations. And it needs to be applied in organizing. Dawn is a certain type of demographic. Yours, Project Diaspora, is another. Diaspora have that middle ground that we can use and enjoy and share probably better than anyone.
You know, but I also think that you know, as we talk about simply about diaspora, is as we rise, I think also our home countries need to begin to recognize how transformative we are, and I think for a lot of them, they view us as both foreigner and with suspicion, you know, because we inherently have the ability to upset the status quo far more probably than external intervention. Members of the diaspora are a transformational force within their country, and that scares a lot of governments. But if we can't really impact that space and change the perception of members of the diaspora if we don't organize and begin to say, you know what, we're not a threat. We're coming here because we love our country and we also want to participate. We're starting to see small pockets of the red carpet being rolled out to members of the diaspora, but it needs to be rolled out a lot faster because we don't have any time to waste. And I think dawdling around, looking at the members of the diaspora as a threat is probably does more damage than whatever those current governments are. Or efforts are trying to do to be transformative within their own countries. So I implore our countries to look at the diaspora as first-class citizens on the continent, not simply because of the remittances that they bring in, but with every dollar that comes into those countries, there is an intellectual capacity that is worth $100. And they need to start tapping into that.
Well, you know, those are great points that both of you were making. And just to pick up in particular, Teddy, on what you were just saying about the disruptive potential that exists in the diaspora and how that can seem like a threat, I really want to kind of hone in on this and look at it both from a U.S. perspective or say host of diaspora populations, but let's focus on the U.S., you know, as well as, you know, in countries of origin, countries of association, affiliation. And, you know, there's this paradox, which is that, you know, on one hand, you know, global growth, increased prosperity in the last 20 years has not come from the United States, Europe, and Japan, the places in the world where wealth has been concentrated over the last 200-300 years, and there's no prospect at all that's going to change the next 30 or 40 years. So anybody who's you know, even minorly registering the trend of history understands that if they want to be part of what's happening in our generation, in our historical moment, we have to be globally connected. And so we had our new president at George Mason University, Dr. Angel Cabrera, on a couple of weeks back talking about, among other things, his new book, Being Global, and how this capacity that you have been describing, you both have been describing, as being almost second nature for folks who are members of diaspora communities is actually a key competitive and a key personal set of qualities for anybody. So on one hand, I think there has to be that understanding. On the other hand, you have you know, the whole, say, you know, travesty and sequence of events around the Arizona immigration law that in some sense traces back to a set of organizations that including the Federation for American Immigration Reform, FAIR, that actually one person was particularly involved in creating. I talk about him in my book. His name is John Tampin. He was featured in a New York Times, front page New York Times article a couple of years ago, and that's what really brought him to my attention. So I did some work, you know, kind of looked into his perspective, and he wrote a paper in 1994, and his statement was, "We are fast approaching the end of the migration epoch. Welcome international migration, legal and especially illegal, is no longer a practical option for almost all of the world's people. Rather, they will have to bloom where they are planted, if they are to bloom at all." Mm. And it's this type of a mindset that informs the, you know, erect walls and barriers, foreigners, immigrants are a threat. You know, we've seen in there's an article just yesterday about sort of paramilitary nationalist groups in Greece is beginning to attack immigrants there, blaming them for what has been going on, you know, in that country. I mean, again, I'm just quoting newspaper reports, but, you know, this is not unusual. How are we going to change the discussion? How are we going to shift the center of gravity so it's not just about showing tolerance to fellow Americans, which seems to be a pretty low bar, and not even about increasing the number of visas that we grant, but actually comprehending the tremendous relational capital that exists in diaspora populations and how that is a dimension of collaborative advantage for the United States that is a key part of our continued relevance and success in the 21st century. How are we going to change this discussion? Any ideas?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, right? I mean, it is part of this absorbing immigrants and newcomers and the walls that you said, that, you know, as they're being built. You know, a lot of that is so much is about, first of all, the habit and the pattern of looking at them as the other and not looking at new arrivals to the United States or to these countries as simply that, new arrivals and new parts of our society. Without going into, you know, details over the terms of their arrival or how immigration should be improved, the fact of the matter is, most people who come here come for a better opportunity and seeking a better life. And it's in those instances that, you know, the innovation and the creativity comes out of necessity, out of the need for opportunity. We know that it's most often immigrants who have taken maybe the jobs and the labor, the unskilled work that so many Americans are not doing. And also, it's also immigrants who are more likely to be creative and start their own small business because they have a unique need that serves their community. Here in Minneapolis, we have a very vibrant Somali-American community and a very vibrant Hmong-American community. In St. Paul is home to the largest concentration of Hmong population in the world because of their refugee status from decades ago. But in that arrival to the Twin Cities has emerged a completely vibrant business sector with both communities. The Hmong American communities are on the rise in the state of Minnesota for working in farmers markets, at processing plants, at opening up small retail shops in particularly rural parts, which is also the interesting dynamic, is the immigration is far and wide and it's reaching different communities. Those are the kinds of stories that make America's, that represent America's truth, which is it's a land of opportunity. You come, you build, you create a business, you have a partnership, and you can give back. There's also another story of a great company here called Sadia's Sauces. And Sadia Sauces is really a woman who came from Somalia. She has her family. She has about four kids, her and her family. She just made this really incredible, delicious sauce. Somali recipe, and it became so popular in the community, people said she should sell it. Well, she did. She finally got it processed and put in cans, and somehow it's not only gone through the Somali community, it's made it on the shelves of mainstream supermarkets here. And, if, you know, she wants to hit the big ones, the big chains. But Sadia sauce is an example of what happens when you take an idea into action and you invest in these communities, these new Americans. And again, as you know, with Somalia, the situation in that country, it hasn't had a government for 20 years. Somalia relies on very much, and unfortunately, investments from its people abroad. So, you know, the international community and Somalis in the diaspora are helping support the lives of millions of people, and not in a handout way. It's also through investment, and that's what diaspora know, that I don't think much of the world also understands, is these stories of a country in flames and people fleeing disaster are sometimes exaggerated, because there's also pockets of security and stability there, and the diaspora know that. And yes, in times of crisis, as in last year's famine, Somalis gave, you know, money in remittances in response to the emergency, but they also gave money in an investment to keep the businesses going and to help the markets, you know, buy more food. It wasn't simply a case of crisis and disaster. These are the elements of investment and opportunity that diaspora can illustrate. I admit, in the case of the African diaspora, we are still very new. We are the youngest population in the world. Last month, another report came out, African Economic Outlook, and it says that by 2045, Africa's population is going to double, which is great for the continent, but it also means that migration is going to increase, and the investment opportunities in that market are huge. Now, diaspora are probably going to be in the lead because of the relationships that already exist, but it is about seeing those opportunities on the horizon, preparing for them. And I do think there are businesses, and myself, I'm in the public sector. I tend to think about civil society and nonprofit space and promoting good governance and transparency. I do think diaspora have a role in that. Those are the kind of opportunities that these immigrants that are here can help promote and sustain and strengthen.
I want to do you have anything to add there, Teddy, before I would go to what maybe our last question? Go ahead. Teddy? I thought I heard Teddy there for a second. Tamar, are you still there?
So we have...
What's that? Okay, yeah.
Twitter. Would you mind?
You're phasing in and out. I don't know what's... I want to make sure that we're... still on with everybody. Teddy, you back?
Yeah, I'm still here. I can hear you guys.
Okay, good. Yeah, and Clem, are you still there?
Yes, and I think there's been a request to reintroduce ourselves to the listeners.
Oh, okay, yeah, go ahead. That sounds good. So why don't you guys both, again, say who you are. And Teddy, I think you were going to say something. I have one last question to both of you. I'm going to try to make sure that we end at 59 minutes and 30 seconds so that the conversation doesn't get cut off, as it has been a couple of times if we go over 60 minutes for the folks who are listening, streaming online. So but why don't you just quickly say who both of you are for the folks who joined late.
Teddy, go ahead.
Yeah, so my name is Teddy Roosh. I'm on Twitter, you can find me as TMS Roosh. I'm the co-founder of Project Diaspora, and I'm based here in D.C., and originally from Uganda.
And my name is Samhara Raya. I am the founder and executive director of Diaspora African Women's Network, which supports next-generation African diaspora women who want to work on African affairs. You can find me on Twitter at Samhara. And I am very proudly Eritrean American diaspora.
and for anybody who sort of found our way here but isn't necessarily following on Twitter, our hashtag is AshokaU Online, and so all of the the handles and everybody's names and everything will be there as well. Now, Teddy, were you about to say something following up on Samar's comments?
No, just briefly. In the perspective that migrants have when they're coming to the land of opportunity, I think a lot of the fear and that comes against members of the diaspora is the fact that, you know, I could be wrong, but this is kind of like a gut feeling, is that we come here looking at everything as a blank slate. We don't come here with a chip on our shoulders. We come here with only a can-do spirit and say, you know what, I'm here now, I'm actually going to accomplish something. And sometimes that can be seen as a threat. It's like, how dare you come in here and all of a sudden be successful? And, you know, then there's this misnomer that, you know, you're coming here to take over the jobs. You're coming here to take over to bring terrorism or to change the American structure, whatever it is. I think that needs to change. We need to look at members of the diaspora as opportunities. It's kind of like, you know, staring at the same problems for so long that you don't even see it anymore. And then someone comes in from the outside and is able to see it immediately and say, hey, you know what? This is what you should do about this, because, you know, you're looking at it from outside the box. We should be tapping into that intellectual capacity and that ability to go straight to the root of the problem and solve it. That is one perspective that we have for our host countries where we are. But as long as we're looked at as threats to the status quo, and I think that's going to be unfortunate. I mean, migration is part of the human condition. We always move to better fields. We always cross the fence to go and find better opportunities across the way, across the pasture. It's in us to do that. And I think with the emergence of the nation state, we become far too protective and fail to see the opportunities that that migration offers to inject a new sense of thinking, a new sense of creativity into problem solving. So hopefully we can get back to that. But that's, you know, I realize that's definitely a long shot looking at recent events.
Fantastic. Well, in the 2.5 minutes that we have left, from each of you, a couple of ways that the folks here participating in Ashoka U Online, regardless of whether or not they affiliate as members of the diaspora community, and you know, looking at the Twitter feed, envisioned at the outset I know many people do, but regardless of that, how can people connect to the energy that you've been describing? What are some strategies, again, regardless of whether or not you're a member of a diaspora community, if we see this energy, we feel it in what you're talking about, how can everybody be part of that energy?
Okay, I'm going to just give a quick acronym as my answer. You know, whether or not you're a member of an identified diaspora, even as an interested person, as a citizen, there's a responsibility we all have. I call it ROPE. And the ROPE is an acronym which stands for represent, you organize, you participate, and you engage. And I firmly believe that diaspora has to do a much better job, African diaspora in particular, at representing our case in a way that is inclusive and inviting and informative, organizing ourselves in different capacities so that we can be heard, not just as businesses or politicals, but also as civil society in teaching and education and arts and humanities. You know, organizing our voices in different ways, participating in the systems that exist, not necessarily always having to create your own, but participating in the process. And lastly, engaging with others. And this goes back to your question about engagement. Being able to sit in conversations like this without walking away, without isolating yourself, without angering each other, really taking the time to listen and learn something new. There's things that our diaspora can learn from older diasporas. This is what I'm looking forward to, is sitting with Armenians and Turks and Iranians and Irish and everyone, and even the smaller ones that I haven't listed. It's that process of a ROPE.
Teddy, can we get something for you in 30 seconds?
Yeah, I think what I want to say is also we shouldn't be afraid of shaking up the status quo and injecting ourselves into the situation, because sometimes that's the only way you're going to get to the microphone. Our voice is important. If we have nothing else at all in this world, we have our voice, we have our agency, and if you continually let other people speak for you, you will never, ever be a person. You will never be counted as an individual if you don't exercise your voice and your agency in your own rescue as a person who has equal rights to
development. You've got it there, Teddy. Thank you both so much. It's been fantastic. We're going to be cutting off now. Let's continue the conversation on Twitter. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you, everyone.
Cheers. Thanks, guys. Thanks, everyone.
Okay, bye.